I'd like to begin this lesson by reading from 2 Corinthians chapter 5. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. It says, "For we know that if the tent, that is our earthly home, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this tent we groan, longing to put on our heavenly dwelling, if indeed by putting it on we may not be found naked. For while we are still in this tent, we groan, being burdened, not that we would be unclothed, but that we would be further clothed, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. He who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who has given us the Spirit as a guarantee. So we are always of good courage. We know that while we are at home in the body, we are away from the Lord. For we walk by faith, not by sight. Yes, we are of good courage, and we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So whether we are at home or away, we make it our aim to please Him. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil." 2 Corinthians is the most personal letter that Paul wrote. And in it, he really opens himself up to the Corinthians, and he helps them to see what it is that is going on inside, the things that drive him and make him tick. He lets them see his fears and his frustrations and his weaknesses. But he also lets them see his confidence, his motivation, and his strength. And when we read the book of 2 Corinthians, what we actually get a glimpse of is what it is that made Paul, Paul. There's so many places where Paul just says, "Look, if you want to know why I am the way that I am, if you want to know what drives me, if you want to know what motivates me, then here it is." And he lays himself open so that they can understand. That's really what this lesson is about, is what is it that drives you? What is your ambition in life? What are your aspirations all about? What is it that makes you tick? In the section that we just read in 2 Corinthians 5, Paul's talking about living life with the perspective of dying. And he knows that one day he will depart his body to be with the Lord. And that's not his final hope. It says here in verse 2, "In this tent we groan, longing to put on our heavenly dwelling." Paul's final hope is for his body to be raised and changed, which he talks about extensively in 1 Corinthians 15. But the point remains that life, as we know it, is temporary. This body, as it is like a tent. Life is like a camping trip. And when it's over, we get to go home. Now, if we really believe that, if we really believe that after this life is over, that we are going to be with God forever, don't you think that's going to have some impact on what we view this life as being all about? Don't you think it'll influence our purpose and our ambitions here? The way that Paul says it here in verse 9 is, "Whether we are at home or away, we make it our aim to please Him." Really, that just makes sense. Because if we do really believe that when this life is over, that we will be with God, that we will see Him as He is, that we will dwell in His presence forever, then pleasing Him ought to be the most important thing in the world to us. It ought to be our highest goal, our greatest ambition in life. Because our purpose in this life will be shaped by the one to come. I'd like for you to look at this verse in a few different translations. I've read from the ESV, which is what I have on the screen here, that says that we make it our aim to please him. The NIV says we make it our goal to please him. A version called the Berean Standard says we aspire to please him. And the New American Standard says we have as our ambition to be pleasing to him. Now, let me ask you this. If you were to imagine somebody in your mind who is very ambitious, now, if you could picture somebody that you would say, that's a very ambitious person, what kind of things do you think that they might aspire to? You would probably imagine somebody that has big goals and aspirations. Somebody who aspires to have a successful business, or climb the ranks of their career path, or become a visionary leader of some kind. But what about somebody who aspires to please God? Somebody who says, that is what my ambition in life is to be pleasing to God. Does that seem like a very lofty aspiration to you? Is that enough for you? Like if that was what you ended up doing with your life, that if you did nothing else, that you were able to live in a way that pleased God, would that be a life that was really worth living? Would that be enough for your kids? When you think about what you want your kids to achieve in life, would it be enough to say that they pleased God? The truth is, there's nothing greater than that. There's nothing higher that we could aspire to than that. Because in the end, pleasing God will be the only thing that matters. And we, of all people, ought to be the ones that recognize that. We ought to understand what a high goal that actually is. Now, this Greek word that's translated as aim or goal or aspire or ambition is a very interesting word. It's pronounced something like philotomeomai, which is fun to say, so you can do that on your own sometime. Philotomeomai. It's actually a compound word, and you might recognize it just by looking at the English transliteration there, but it's made up of two words, the word philos, which means lover, and the word time, which means honor. And so that first part of the word philos is the root word of Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, or Theophilus, lover of God. And we see that word pop up a lot of times in English. But the idea is that this word means to show affection for what is personally valued or personally honored. And isn't that the way that it works? That your aim in life, your goals and your aspirations and your ambitions will be shaped by whatever it is that you view as being most important. Whatever it is that you esteem highly enough to demand your attention and your effort will be the thing that shapes the course of your life. Whatever's most important to you will determine what you are ambitious for. You know, Jesus talked like that too. In Matthew chapter 6, in verse 20 and 21, he said, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." You know, sometimes I think that we think about that backwards, and we think that it's like, you know, where your heart is, that's where your treasure will be. But that's not what Jesus said. He said, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Your heart follows your treasure. Your affections follow the things that you esteem as valuable. And so if heavenly treasure is what you have, if you treasure the things of heaven, if you treasure spiritual things, if you treasure God's things, your heart will follow your treasure. See? Your ambitions will be shaped by what you view as valuable. And so if what we value is totally different than what the world values, then what that means is that our ambitions will be totally different than the world's ambitions. The way that we view success will be different than the way the world views success. The way that we view achievement will be different than the way the world views achievement. Let me show you another place where this word is used. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 9 through 12. Paul writes, "Now concerning brotherly love, you have no need for anyone to write to you, for you yourselves have been taught by God to love one another. For that indeed is what you are doing to all the brothers throughout Macedonia. But we urge you, brothers, to do this more and more, and to aspire to live quietly, and to mind your own affairs, and to work with your hands as we instructed you, so that you may walk properly before outsiders and be dependent on no one." So the same word is used there in verse 11. Here it's translated as the word aspire. So what is it that Paul encourages these Thessalonian saints to aspire to in life? Well, in verse 11, he tells them to aspire to live quietly, to mind their own business, to work good and honest jobs and provide for themselves. Does that sound, I don't know, small to you? You know, like, that's not the way the world would say that we need to set our aspirations. The world would say, you've got to dream bigger than that, you know? Like, you've got to make a name for yourself. You've got to do something great. You've got to shoot for the stars. Don't settle for anything small. A quiet life seems boring. But look at verse 12 again. Because verse 12 shows us why this is worth aspiring to. He says, "It is so that you may walk properly before outsiders and be dependent on no one." You see, our life is shaped by our desire for other people to experience salvation through the gospel as well. And when we free ourselves of the worldly shackles of ambition, that we put ourselves in a position to reach the lost. When other people can see that we have goals and aspirations that are greater than what this world can offer. When outsiders see that we are willing to work good and honest jobs and live a quiet and peaceful life, because we realize that our ultimate satisfaction is in heaven, then it makes an impact on them. That's when they'll be able to see the glory of the hope within us. It's very similar to 1 Timothy chapter 2. In 1 Timothy 2, verses 1 through 4, Paul says, "First of all, then, I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings be made for all people, for kings and all who are in high positions, that we may lead a peaceful and quiet life, godly and dignified in every way. This is good, and it is pleasing in the sight of God our Savior, who desires all people to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth." You know, sometimes I think that we stop short at verse 2 here. And maybe there's a part of us that wants to have a peaceful and quiet life. And I think that pretty much all of us would recognize the value of living in a way that is godly and dignified. But don't miss why that is valuable. Don't miss why it's important. It's in verses 3 and 4. He says, this is good, and it is pleasing in the sight of God our Savior, who desires all people to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. You see, when we recognize the supreme value of being saved, when that is the thing that we see as the greatest thing, when salvation is the most important thing to us, that's when we'll recognize the supreme value of pleasing God. And our greatest ambitions in life will be filled with doing His will and with spreading the gospel to others. I'd like for you to think about what Paul says in 1 Timothy 3. As we go on in this letter to Timothy, in chapter 3, he goes on to talk about a noble aspiration. And in verse 1, he says, the saying is trustworthy. If anyone aspires to the office of overseer, he desires a noble task. Stop there for just a moment. Paul tells Timothy that somebody with a godly ambition or somebody that has a noble desire will aspire to being an elder. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we had more men who aspired to be elders? If we had more young men who had that view in mind from the beginning, that they wanted to marry somebody that would serve in that role with them one day. If they wanted to have a family and raise children and teach them the truth so that they would then be qualified to serve in the family of God, that'd be wonderful. If we had more middle-aged and older men who began to think about actually stepping up to the task because they aspired to doing something great. You know, if you were to go through this list of qualifications, you could see each one of them as being a goal worth aspiring to. He says in verse 2 that an overseer must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, sober-minded, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not a drunkard, not violent, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. He must manage his own household well, with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. You could think about every one of those qualifications as being something that we can aspire to. A noble ambition for us to undertake in life. And please understand that this doesn't just apply to men and to elders. This would describe the kind of life that is godly and dignified in every way. That you might be somebody that isn't the husband of one wife, but you might be the wife of one husband. Or if your marital situation is different for one reason or another, you could still live in a way that is godly and dignified. But this is what it looks like when somebody says, I'm going to live my life in a way that honors God. I'm going to live my life in a way that is shaped by the wisdom of God's word. I want to live my life in a way that exemplifies His wisdom to the world around us. This is a life that's worthy of aspiring to. And again, I just have to say, it's very different than what the world would aspire to. The world would aspire to all kinds of worldly success or riches or fame or popularity or power or things like that. But this is a noble aspiration. Now, this word that's used in verse 1, that's translated aspire, is actually a different word than we saw in 2 Corinthians 5 and in 1 Thessalonians 4. This word is the word oregomai. And literally it means to stretch out, to reach after, or to yearn for. It's actually used only three times in the New Testament. We've just seen one. That's 1 Timothy 3 and verse 1. But now let's look at a second place where this word is used. It's in 1 Timothy chapter 6. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 9. Paul says, "But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evils. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs." So here the ESV translates the same word as craving. It's the same word that was translated as aspire in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 1. And so Paul is saying that it is through this aspiration, or it is through this ambition of making money or wanting money, that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. And so here is an example of worldly ambition and where it leads. Paul calls it a snare. It's like a trap, you know? Like, you think that if you could only get that thing, that you would be satisfied and fulfilled. And Paul says, you've got to be able to see through that. There are people who live their whole lives trying to get just a little bit more, that are being baited along by this little carrot, where they think that if they could only get a little more, then they'll have enough. And Paul says that's a trap. If you want to live a life that is full of disappointment and full of sorrow, then live with worldly ambition. Worldly treasure is doomed to rust and decay. And so worldly ambition can only end with emptiness and disappointment. And we should know better. Because our ambitions are shaped by heavenly treasure. What we yearn for, what we reach for, what we stretch ourselves out for is for an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading. You can't say that about anything else on this earth. We are reaching after that which neither moth nor rust destroys, and thieves do not break in and steal. There's a song called "Turn Your Eyes Upon Jesus." It's a very old song. But the refrain of the song says, "Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace." That's the kind of perspective that we ought to have. That as we begin to see the beauty and the glory of godly ambition, that the world's ambitions just seem less and less attractive. Because we know that we have something better. Now let me show you the third place where this word is used. It's in Hebrews chapter 11. Let's read verses 13 through 16. At the end of this section where he's been talking about these great men and women of faith, he says here in verse 13, "These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city." In this great chapter of examples of faith, the writer makes the statement that these people were all willing to leave behind what was lesser for that which was greater. They fixed their eyes on the promises of God, and those promises transformed the way that they lived this life on this earth. In verse 13, it says they acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. In verse 16, it says that they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. And again, that is our word. Desire is the same word that's translated as aspire in 1 Timothy 3, or craving in 1 Timothy 6. But when these people began to treasure heavenly things, their ambitions changed. Their aim in life changed. They were no longer seeking fulfillment in the things that this world could offer. Instead, they made it their ambition to please God. They were stretching out, reaching after, and yearning for something better than what this world could give them. And it's for that reason that I really love the way that this chapter ends. In verses 37 and 38, it talks about the suffering that some of these people were willing to go through because of the value of what they had ahead of them. And in verse 37, he says, they were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were killed with the sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy. Wandering about in deserts and mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. Now here's what I love about this phrase in verse 38. He says that these were people of whom the world was not worthy. On the surface, it would seem just the opposite. From the world's perspective, it would appear that these people are not worthy of the world, you know? The world is all about, worldly ambition is all about wealth or status or accomplishment or pleasure. And these people had none of that. They were nobodies. They were hiding in caves. They were wearing skins of sheep and goats. And what the writer of Hebrews wants us to understand is that it is just the opposite from the way the world would view them. The world would say that these people are not worthy of the world, but the writer knows that the truth is this. The world is not worthy of them. That's the choice that we have to make. Is this world enough for you? Is this world enough for you? If it is, then let's eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Let's have worldly values and worldly ambitions. Let's aspire to finding all the fulfillment that we can in the things of this life. But if this world is not enough for us, then let's aspire to something greater. Let's lay up for ourselves treasures in heaven and let that shape our ambitions. Let's make it our aim to please God. Let's aspire to live in a way that brings others to Christ. And let's live this life with a purpose that's shaped by the one to come. That's the lesson this morning. There might be somebody here who realizes just how empty worldly ambition is. And the truth is that Jesus is inviting you to live with a purpose that is much more satisfying, much more fulfilling, and much more lasting than anything that this world can offer. If you are tired, if you are heavy laden, Jesus can give you rest. Jesus can give you satisfaction. Jesus can give you fulfillment. Jesus can give you a hope that transcends this life. And you can make it your ambition to please God as you walk with Him. If you need to make your life right with God in some way, if you have not yet become a Christian, or if you want to ask for the prayers of the saints here, you have the opportunity to let that be known before you leave. We'd invite you to come to the front while we stand and sing.